Hello, I'm Adam Levy, and this is Working Scientist, a Nature Careers podcast. In this special episode, we're looking at the two winners of the 2019 John Maddox Prize. The John Maddox Prize is from Nature and Sense About Science, a charity that challenges the misrepresentation of science and evidence in public life. The prize recognises outstanding efforts to promote science and evidence, even in the face of challenges and hostility. And the winners of the award this year truly capture that spirit. Selecting them is not an easy job. Scientists and scientific institutions sent in over 200 nominations. That's 10 times more than when the prize began in 2012. And that number includes individuals like Malegapuru William Makoba, standing up against AIDS denial in South Africa, and Mark Edwards, who exposed the Flint water contamination crisis in Michigan. But sadly, the judges can only select two winners. The first of these is the winner of the John Maddox Early Career Prize. This year, the judges gave the award to Olivier Bernard, a pharmacist from Montreal, Canada. Given the back catalogue of his work, it's hard to believe he is indeed still early in his career.
I'm part pharmacist and part science communicator nowadays. I draw comics about health, especially about myths regarding healthcare. So perceptions people have about that can be about medications, about natural health products. And I also have now, I publish some books. I have a TV show about scientific skepticism.
Olivier was awarded the prize for his science communication. Most notably, he has repeatedly called out the use of vitamin C injections in the treatment of cancer. When we spoke, he told me he'd got quite a shock when he found out he'd been awarded the prize.
It's actually one of my readers from my website who she wrote to me and she said, I want to nominate you for this award. So I knew of the award, but I told her, look, there's no way I can win this, but if you want to do it, sure, fine, go ahead. So who knows then? It feels amazing, but it's a huge surprise.
As a pharmacist, what kind of prompted you? What made you want to start making comics and talking more about misconceptions in science and in medicine?
I think the main driver was frustration, to be honest. as a pharmacist and anybody who works in healthcare or even science in general, I mean, we're confronted with all of these weird beliefs that people have sometimes. And often these are beliefs that we know, I mean, we've known for a long time that they're incorrect. And it amazed me at the time that I had to explain these things every day to different people. So I thought, is there any way I can do that on a larger scale so I can inform more people at the same time?
Now, when did you first become aware of vitamin C injections?
In early 2018, some of my readers wrote to me, they sent me emails saying that there was a petition starting up that was gaining quite a lot of attention. It was a petition requesting for the government to cover the vitamin C injections for people with cancer, because apparently it can help to reduce side effects of chemotherapy. So I was made aware of that in early 2018, and the reader said I should write an article about that. And I did. I wrote a paper with some of my drawings explaining, you know, what was wrong with this petition, what was right. And yeah, it started like that. It was just one of the many articles I was writing on my website, and I didn't expect anything special from it.
How did you feel when you first heard about these injections? Because I suppose, you know, they're for very vulnerable people, people who are trying to recover from cancer therapies.
It strikes a chord with me. There's something that just gets to me when it comes to cancer, because these people, as you say, they're so vulnerable and they're just willing to try sometimes anything. So in that case, I felt really strongly about that, about these vitamin C injections, because I felt I was pretty certain there was no evidence behind it. And as a matter of fact, that was the case.
Yeah, so you not only wrote this article, which made that clear, you also looked into the petition itself, and what did you find there?
The way that they promoted this petition is by going to public figures, celebrities. There was a lot of attention in the media. They appeared in TV shows, on radio shows. So they got so much attention. And also, they managed to get the interest of a member of a political party here in Quebec. And this politician said, all right, now this is my project. I'm going to take this petition and we're going to make that happen. And that was the part that just, I thought that was so scary to hear this politician say that without even knowing the evidence, most likely.
And when you raised these issues, the issues of how the petition was being promoted and also the treatment itself not having evidence to support it, the response to you doing this wasn't necessarily positive, right?
No, I mean, when I wrote the article in early 2018, I got a lot of pushbacks. I mean, for several months, I was getting insults and like those vague threats pretty much every day. I mean, it was pretty bad, but it got much, much worse. Later on, in early 2019, the petition was at 120,000 people. For us in Quebec, it's a lot. It's a big, one of the biggest petitions in history. And then I tried to address directly the politician in question, and that's where it got really, really bad. He made some kind of statement on his Facebook page, and I wrote to him publicly. So I asked him to kind of back up his initiative. And the people who were supporting the petition, they really did not like that. And there's a group supporting the petition who decided to just break me, basically. So they started sending complaints to my broadcaster, and they were asking for my shows to be canceled. They revealed the address of a pharmacy where I work. They harassed my wife. And my wife has nothing to do about that. I mean, she writes children's books, and they called for a boycott of her books. They sent her death threats. That was so bad, really. And it was an extremely stressful time for us, for both of us.
Yeah, I mean, how did you cope? Because that just sounds like so much to deal with.
So what I decided to do is just, I decided to talk about it publicly, because I felt like nobody was really aware of that. I did a post on my social network saying, look, this is what is going on. So, you know, I can keep doing this alone. And the result was just amazing. There was this huge outcry from the local scientific community.
And what kind of changes have there actually been as a result of this outpouring?
Well, first, medical associations suddenly, after a year, they came forward and saying, hey, look, this guy, what he's saying is, I mean, he's right. There's no evidence to back this up. So very quickly, the politician who was supporting the petition, he had to take a step back. And shortly afterwards, the government announced that they would not be accepting the petition. It was amazing to hear the government say that. And then a few weeks later, I got some emails from people in the government and also medical associations who said, hey, we didn't know this could happen. So now there's these two task force who are right now thinking about how can scientists be protected or supported when something like that happens to them. So that was really the best thing that happened. Those two things, that was just the best that came out of it, I think.
What advice would you give to other researchers who see claims online that they know to be false or they know not to be backed up by evidence? What advice would you give to them in terms of how they speak out?
People in the field of science and healthcare, we need to be more proactive. I mean, we see claims that are incorrect or incomplete or completely false. I mean, all the time. And the truth is, most people don't do anything about it. We just feel like it's not our responsibility to do it. So what I tell them is, yes, it is our responsibility, because if we're not taking our place in public debates like this, I mean, other people are taking our spot. Like, I'm not asking people to become science communicators, but we can all do our part. If we hear something that's incorrect and it's in our field of expertise, we have to speak, because that's the problem right now. We're not vocal enough about those issues.
Now, a lot of people might want to speak out, but might be scared of going through similar experiences to you, you know, being attacked personally. What advice would you give to people who may be concerned about the consequences of speaking out?
First of all, I would tell them that it's normal to be scared, but don't do this alone. Find some help through colleagues and try to gain some support. I would suggest going, if you have the privilege of being in an association of scientists or in healthcare, contact them and tell them about it and ask them for guidance. We're all very passionate about what we do, and we care about facts, we care about the scientific method, but I think we should also care about our communication skills. And I think it's going to increase people's confidence, not only in science, but also in scientists, and show them that, you know, we're scientists, but we're also just normal people.
That was Olivier Bernard, winner of the 2019 John Maddox Early Career Prize. The John Maddox Prize is a joint initiative between Sense About Science and Nature, and is named after former Nature editor John Maddox. John edited the magazine for 22 years in total, bringing a combination of scientific and journalistic rigour to the role. So who better to name these awards after? The second winner of the awards has been standing strong in the name of scientific evidence for decades now. Bamanhiro Sario is a professor of forest protection at IPB University in Indonesia. Illegal peatland fires are a huge problem in Indonesia, perhaps most notoriously to clear forest to make room for palm oil agriculture. Bamban is a crucial part of the fight against this arson, serving as the Indonesian government's lead expert witness on illegal peatland fires. And he has served as witness on many, many fires.
Since 2000, about 500 cases. You know, sometimes I do not remember.
Bamban still remembers how he became involved in this battle shortly after finishing his studies.
When I just returned from my study, when I go to the field, I finally found that, wow, they are starting to destroy our environment. So I have been asked by the police at Jakarta office, Bambang, I think you have the skill and science to fight those companies behind of those fires. What do you think? And they said, okay.
And ever since, Bambang has been providing evidence to help courts decide who is behind forest fires. In fact, we spoke the night before he was appearing for one of his many cases.
So I should give a testimony in front of the court tomorrow morning. This is a fire that occurred in oil palm plantations, about 833 hectare burns.
Bamban was up against hundreds of other nominees for the John Maddox Prize, but the judges had no doubt he deserved the award. In fact, one judge said, I've never known in the history of this prize such consensus within the judges from the outset. Even so, Bamban himself was completely taken aback by the honour.
For me, it looked like dreams, you know. I don't believe that I win this prize because I spent 20 years working on the field. It seemed that I work alone.
But the real value comes from the work itself. These fires devastate the local environment and produce immense amounts of greenhouse gases. But there are also severe impacts on people living close to these blazes, especially for expectant mothers, as Bamban explained to me when we spoke.
From the smoke, we took samples and analyzed. We finally recognized we got 90 gases from peat fires, where more than 50% of these gases is very harmful to the human being. You can imagine if this kind of gases and then absorbed by the young mothers that are pregnant, then the baby will abnormal. So this is very dangerous. And also, we have a bad experience a couple years ago because of these fires where one airplane crashed.
What's the hardest part of providing evidence and getting that evidence in the first place?
Yeah, the first one, we need actually the maps. We would like to reconstruct the information on forest fire. And then from there, then we can understand how come this fire occurred here. This is number one. And the second one is about to get the samples in the field. And then the other ones also, we need some data from the company. Sometimes, you know, they keep those data.
Now, of course, when you're presenting this information in court, you're not necessarily presenting it to people who are also trained scientists. You know, the judges don't have the scientific background maybe that you have. Is it hard to communicate science in a way that you can be sure it will be understood?
Yeah, this is another problem. The question is how we guarantee, how we make sure that those data is expressing the field situation.
For you, how do you find this process of going to court and presenting evidence? Do you get nervous or do you enjoy it? What's it like?
The big company behind those fires, they have very, very good lawyers. Of course, in the beginning, I'm very nervous. Why? Because all then depend on what I should present during the court. So if my presentation is bad, then maybe the case will be closed. And you should know also these lawyers, they have also invited the expert. This expert sometimes give information to this lawyer to fight me.
It sounds like a challenging process, but I hear that the challenges also exist outside the courtroom and that there's been quite a big impact on yourself and also on your family.
They try to intimidate. So they start with this. They intimidate, they call, sometimes they bring the car to import my house, and sometimes they go to my college campus. So this is in order to make me afraid, so then decided not to continue on my testimony.
And a palm oil company actually tried to intimidate you with a multi-million dollar lawsuit. What ended up happening with this case?
I got more than 160,000 support from these peoples, not only Indonesia, and also from foreign countries. It means that we should save Bambang. I'm lucky because finally the court reject. So it means that now I am free.
It must have been amazing to see so many people signing this petition.
Oh, yes, of course. So I'm even my wife, she's crying because she never thought that everybody is looking what I'm doing in the field.
Do any of your colleagues say you shouldn't do this work, it's too dangerous or it's not worth the risks?
I have many comment from them. Bambang, you know, this is very dangerous for you and your family. And then he said that it's better you stop this kind of activities. But I have also a suggestion. If I know this kind of problems, the environmental disaster, you know, continues. It is naive. If I know those things, then I couldn't stop it. Then we do hope that as academicians, we should be part of the solutions, not part of the problems.
Do you have a message for researchers who maybe want to do similar work, but are nervous about the consequences for themselves?
I have a simple message that if you are a real scientist, when you work on the right track and the right places or the right ways, don't worry. Many people will support you and will give you more power. There is no choice. We should fight and go to the field for this kind of activities.
That was Bambang Hirosaryo, winner of this year's John Maddox Prize. The award was presented to Bambang and Olivier at the Wellcome Collection in London on Tuesday the 12th of November, along with the prize money of £3,000. Thank you for tuning in to this special edition of Working Scientist and learning about the outstanding work of both Bambang and Olivier that have earned them their awards. I'm Adam Levy.